Tonight we're looking at John 18, verses 19 to 40, so we'll finish up chapter 18 this evening. Courage in court, cowering in the courtyard. This is what scholars think might be the general layout of the home of Caiaphas and Annas. Caiaphas was high priest, but Annas was his father-in-law, who had been high priest before that. He kind of pulled the strings. He was the real powerhouse. We'll look a little more at the two of them. But Jesus was facing Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, and then Peter was in the courtyard having his own occasion where he did his denials. So two of the three denials come up in our passage. We do have a revision on the schedule, so please note we will not be meeting on January the 25th. So last time I had indicated that we would be meeting then. Diane is going to be having knee surgery in February, so as we get into January, we'll know what our schedule will be at that time as well. So, okay, courage in the court and cowering, that would be the corrected title, or cowardice in the courtyard. Let's look once again at the timeline of Jesus' ministry. Many of the events are in John's Gospel. They're listed on the bottom. If they do appear in John, I've given chapters. But we have three Passovers listed in John. I have used the word Pesach because that's a little shorter than Passover. Three of the four Passovers are mentioned in John. You'll notice that the second Passover is in Luke 6. It's indirectly hinted at, shall we say, in Luke. But right now we are in Passover season, and in fact, we are looking on the night of Thursday into Friday, April the 3rd of the year 33 is the date of Jesus' crucifixion. So we're getting very close to the end of Jesus' ministry here at this point. Let's consider the events of the final visit to Jerusalem. It started on March the 28th with his arrival in Bethany. Bethany is a little over a mile away from Jerusalem. And then we have the events going on through Thursday. We've spent quite a bit of time on Thursday. We started last time in Jesus' trials. We're going to have a continuation of trials. And so we are looking partly at Thursday night and partly at Friday morning. Actually, this would also be John chapter 18 and 19. I put John 19 only here. That is something I will want to adjust. Here's our basic outline for tonight. Jesus is going to be questioned by the high priest. I will explain how it is that you can have two people who could be called high priest. We'll get into that a little later. We have Peter's second and third denials. Then the first appearance before Pilate, and then the choice between Barabbas and or Jesus. Annas is the man that Jesus will appear before, and he's like the puppet master. From the year 6 to 15 AD, he was high priest. The Romans wanted him out of that office, but they allowed him to retain his power. So he was the one always pulling the strings. He had four sons and one son-in-law, Caiaphas, who all succeeded him as high priest, and also one grandson became high priest. So Annas will be mentioned and Caiaphas will also be mentioned. Caiaphas was high priest from the year 18 to 36 AD. Jesus' crucifixion is in the year 33. So Caiaphas is the official high priest. Annas, though, was given the honorific title of high priest, even though he was no longer recognized as high priest by the Romans. So this painting here depicts an artist's conception of Annas and Caiaphas. And so in 18:19, that verse, the high priest Annas interrogated Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. And so the first thing here that's important is Annas is seeking to get Jesus to incriminate himself. Similar to our Fifth Amendment, Jewish law did not expect for defendants to incriminate themselves. The case needed to be made by those that were bringing the charges. But Annas is doing exploratory questioning. This does not seem to be an official court trial, but there weren't supposed to be any trials for a capital crime, which is Jesus is accused of a capital crime. There were not supposed to be any night trials. You might say, well, what difference does it make whether it's daytime or nighttime? Why is it that nighttime trials were illegal under Jewish law? Well, it made it far harder to be sure that all of the appropriate witnesses would be there. And in fact, Jesus is even going to say that there are people who could testify on his behalf. That's going to come up very shortly. But we have a nighttime trial. We're going to have more nighttime trials. Annas is exploring. He's hoping to find some additional things if Jesus were to make some unguarded statements that could be used to add charges against Jesus. The questioning about his teaching, his doctrine, is also looking to see if there's anything that he would incriminate himself. The question about his disciples, the issue there is that they are looking to see if they can come up with charges that they were planning to start an insurrection. You may remember back in John chapter 11, the statement was made as a Sanhedrin was gathered together that if we don't stop this man, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away our place and our position, or our nation and our position. The concern that they had was, well, if everyone believes in Jesus as Messiah, well, then what's going to happen is there's going to be a revolution. And if there's a revolution, then the Romans have no further need of the Sadducees. Let me explain how this works. The Sadducees were given a fiefdom by the Romans. They were allowed to become rich. They were allowed to make money by skimming from the temple. The Romans did not object to this as long as the Sadducees could prevent riots. If it turned out that they lost control of the populace, then the Romans would come in, they would restore order, and they would find no further need to allow the Sadducees to become rich by being sort of the intermediaries between the Romans and the populace. So this is the reason that the Sadducees, high priests, chief priests, the whole hierarchy among the priesthood was tightly connected with the Sadducees. They were the ones in power, and they definitely did not want there to be riots. They would do anything that they could in order to appease the Romans by keeping the peace. Now, Jesus gives an answer in verse 20. I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where the Judeans, and I will explain later why it is that I translate it as Judeans every time the word appears. I do not translate it as Jews. Where the Judeans always meet, and in secret, I have said nothing. Now, Jesus is mentioning his teaching in the temple, his teaching in the synagogues around the country. He's saying, I have taught publicly, and I don't have a separate secret message. I'm not giving coded language in order to trigger my followers using code words that you might not understand. Now, so he's saying, I don't speak with a fork and tongue. That's essentially the point that he's making. So the issue here becomes, as Jesus points it out, you can ask all the people that have heard me. They would serve as witnesses in my trial if you're interested in a fair trial. But instead, this is a show trial. This is a kangaroo court. It's their mind has already been made up that Jesus is going to be convicted. Way back in John chapter 11, the decision was reached after Jesus raised Lazarus that Jesus would be put to death. Interestingly, the Talmud indicates that Jesus was sentenced to death 40 days before he was put to death. That would be approximately the time of the raising of Lazarus. And that would coincide with what John 11 says. There are some details in the Talmud that are incorrect, but I think that the timing probably is correct. Now, I would like to explain here what Jesus means when he says, in secret I have said nothing. Jesus is not saying, he is absolutely not saying, I have never met privately. When Nicodemus came, yes, there were people, I argue, that Nicodemus brought along with him. But he didn't bring along Caiaphas, he didn't bring along Annas, he didn't bring people who were opposed to Jesus. His statement, his opening statement was, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no man can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. Jesus wasn't speaking all this publicly, this was spoken in a private meeting. When Jesus met with the Samaritan woman, the disciples were gone. And in fact, when the disciples came back from buying food, they were shocked that he was talking with a woman, and especially that he was doing it alone. Jesus is not saying, I've never had a private conversation. Furthermore, he often met with his disciples. There are various passages where we're told that when he had taken his disciples off by themselves, for example, in Matthew 13, the disciples asked him privately, well, what do all these parables mean? And Jesus explained to them privately. So when it says, In private or in secret, I said nothing. Jesus is not making a statement. I've never spoken to anyone privately. Furthermore, we have occasions that he does speak privately with the Father. Even in John 6, he went up on the mountain by himself and he prayed. There are various other times that we find him by himself. What Jesus is affirming here is, I don't have one public message and a private message, and then speak in Pig Latin, speak in code, so that my followers understand what I'm saying. I don't speak with a fork and tongue. Let me carry this on a little further. I remember one time, I was fairly little, of watching a war movie, and my mother was sitting there, and the situation was this group of Germans had commandeered a truck, and they had its driver being held at gunpoint and telling him, you know, go through the checkpoint and, you know, don't alert the guards and so on and so forth. And the whole idea would be they'd be a Trojan horse and they would enter into the camp and then start shooting with their machine guns, and all sorts of Americans would die. And so obviously the driver is afraid, I'm going to get shot if I somehow alert the guard at the gate, he'll get shot, and so on and so forth. So in the movie, the concept is cooperate and you'll live a little bit longer. So he's talking with the guard at the gate, and he says, "Airy J's in the up tray." And I asked, "Father, what's that?" I didn't understand anything about Pig Latin, so it was when I was very young. Well, Jerry's, that is, Germans, are in the truck, so they were going up in a Jeep, and then behind there was this truck. And so here we have a statement in Pig Latin that's saying, "I am fluent in Pig Latin." But Airy J's in the up tray, the German that was guarding this driver had no idea and was thinking, gee, I don't know that vocabulary, but he would have no idea that the sentry would understand what was being said. Well, then pretty soon they sprayed the truck with machine gun fire, and the day was saved. Okay, now, how is it that we have two high priests? Caiaphas is called high priest, Annas is called high priest, but there's only one high priest at a time. This is going back to Ronald Reagan's funeral procession. It was a state funeral, and you'll notice that the horse that is in the foreground that lacks a rider, that standard procedure that horse is depicting that the president is not sitting on it. He's not riding it. The caisson, that's carrying the casket, dates back to the Civil War. I mean, it's a special state ceremony when you have a funeral for a president or a former president. And so during the broadcast, they would say, "President Reagan." Well, he's not alive, so he's not president, and it had been years since he had served as president. Same way, the Annas is referred to as high priest in an honorific way, even though officially his son-in-law, Caiaphas, is the high priest. It's not a point of error in the text. People refer to him as high priest. John is just using terminology that was used. Even the temple policeman is going to refer to Annas as the high priest. What does Jesus say? What is his response when Annas is asking about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus said, I didn't have a code language. Ask any of my followers. Now clearly, since there were many, many, many people who had followed Jesus, people would start to get an idea if there were code language, some sort of pig Latin that allowed Jesus to hide his message, but then to say it to those who were in the know, those that understood pig Latin. Jesus is saying, I didn't speak with a fork and tongue. My message in public and my message in private were consistent. I am not leading a revolution. That is the precise nature of what Annas is looking for. He's wanting to find any evidence that would allow him to say to Pilate, Jesus was planning to start an insurrection. That's the evidence that they're looking for. The whole thing here is they know how they're going to go about their trial because they've already found Jesus guilty. It doesn't matter whether evidence is presented or not, but they need the cooperation of Pilate. And anything that will make Pilate think that Jesus is dangerous is what they're looking for. So that's the nature of what Jesus is saying. I didn't have a secret revolutionary message. I had one consistent message. That was one that I uttered in public, and that was one I uttered in private. Well, what we have here in verse 22, when he had said these things, one of the deputies standing by struck Jesus, saying, do you answer the high priest thus? This was not an appropriate conduct. This is outside of the rules. But he said, you're being disrespectful to Annas. But he was not. What Jesus was saying is, there are official rules of how a trial is to be conducted. You are not supposed to be trying to get me to incriminate myself. What you're supposed to be doing is finding any evidence that would make your case. The appropriate place for you to go is to ask questions of my followers. Now, they don't want to do that. The larger percentage of Jesus' followers were Galileans. And we'll talk about they don't really want to get Galileans involved. They really want this evening and in the morning to be strictly between Judeans, particularly Judeans that are favorable to the Sanhedrin. They do not want to get any of Jesus' allies involved at all. So, this now prepares us for a change of venue. I didn't put here what I could have put. Once again, Jesus was being interrogated in Annas' apartment, or perhaps a common room that might have been shared between Caiaphas and Annas. Caiaphas is busy making the arrangements for being able to meet with the Sanhedrin, so that may well have been at a different location rather than at the home. But in any event, and John doesn't detail that as synoptic gospels do, but we have the second and third denials in verses 25 through 27. Now, it is mentioned here, now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So people said to him, you're not one of his disciples also, are you? So he denied it and said, I am not. John mentions the charcoal fire. This is not the only place in John where there is a charcoal fire. There will be another one in John chapter 21 when Jesus prepares fish for breakfast for the disciples. You may remember that Jesus asked Peter three times there, "Do you love me?" That seems to be a mirror image of the three times that Peter has denied Jesus. So the charcoal fire plays an interesting role here in relation to John 21. One of the reasons that Peter became so upset was he was reminded three denials and three questionings by Jesus. But there's more to the charcoal fire than may hit you at first glance. Now, in Jerusalem, it can snow, and this is in early April, so it can get cool. It's 3,000 feet elevation and so forth, so a charcoal fire at this time would be a welcome thing. And all of those that were in the courtyard, having no roof, they needed a fire in order to stay close. But there's something else here, something easy to overlook. When you have a fire, if you're facing it, which Peter was up close so he could get warm, it makes one's face a little more apparent. Remember, when they came to arrest Jesus, they came with torches, along with weapons and so forth. So those who were at the in the garden when Jesus was arrested would have seen Peter's face, and the fact that Peter used his sword against the high priest's servant would make it so that Peter's face would likely be one that would be remembered. And here he is in front of a fire to stay warm. It's increasing visibility. So here we have second denial. Now, let me talk a little bit about that first denial. Kind of odd that Peter would have said, "Well, no, I'm not one of his disciples," in the denial that we had earlier in chapter 18, because who was it in front of? It was in front of the servant girl that kept the door. Now, how was it that he was able to get in the door? John was let in by her because, as we said in that message, John's family had a history with the high priest's family because John's family was wealthy and they ran in similar circles and so forth. So Peter is allowed in because he knows John. John is known to be a disciple, and it's like, okay, well, if you're with him, you must be a disciple too. And Peter denied it. Once again, Peter denies it, just as Jesus had predicted back in John 13:38 that he would deny him three times. So now he says, I am not. That is, I am not one of his disciples. And then he's asked again, one of the high priest's servants, being related to the one whose ear Peter had severed, said, "Did I not see you in the garden?" No, I was not in the garden. And back in John 13:38, Jesus predicted this. So in verse 27, so Peter again denied it, and immediately a rooster crowed. Something that's mentioned by John, and it helps us to understand the setting of all this, where it is that Jesus was being interrogated is within eyeshot of where Peter was. Because when Peter denied the third time and the rooster crowed, Luke tells us that Peter and Jesus' eyes met, and then Peter went away and wept bitterly. So this is part of the background as to why I'm talking about this as occurring in the same location, same building, as where Jesus was being interrogated. So it's natural that John, as he's writing this, is going to shift between the scenes, because the scenes are occurring in the same building, and lo and behold, John has access further in probably than Peter did. So now they've skipped over the time before Caiaphas, which is detailed in the synoptics, but we're going to have the appearance before Pilate. And so in verse 28, so they brought Jesus from Caiaphas. So notice it has, he's been sent bound to Caiaphas, but we didn't have any treatment of that appearance before Caiaphas. So they brought him from Caiaphas to the palace, to the praetorium, and it was early morning. But they did not enter the palace or the praetorium, lest they be defiled, but so that they might eat the Passover. We're going to need to discuss geography and chronology here a little bit. On the left-hand side, I have a generalized map of Jerusalem, and the upper city is a little higher in elevation, and you'll notice on the right-hand side, then I've detailed the parts that are important. The house of Caiaphas, if it's been properly identified, is where we have the blue square with the yellowed background, and then the praetorium, the palace, would be in the upper left on that. And so it's not a very long distance. The scale of distance for the inset map is above it. So here in 1828, we have a fairly short transfer that occurs. Jesus is, of course, under guard. This is one of the reasons that people have stayed there in the courtyard. They know that they're going to have to transfer Jesus once their trials have been concluded. So they come before Pilate. But there's an interesting statement that it says that when they brought Jesus to Pilate, the chief priests who were involved in this would not enter the palace because that would defile them. Going into the house of a Gentile, but they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. If they were ritually defiled, there would be a backup Passover that was prescribed by the Old Testament that would occur a month later, but they wanted to eat this Passover at this time. In the model of the city of Jerusalem, this is the way that they have depicted the praetorium or the palace. Pilate did not normally live here. Normally he was up in Caesarea Philippi, but at all of the feasts, in order to be on top of things if there were any riots, the governor would always move down to Jerusalem during the time of the feast. Now, still getting into background here on some of the details, I'm still aiming towards answering how it is that Jesus could have eaten the Passover, and yet the high priests are concerned about maintaining ritual purity for their yet future eating of the Passover. I mean, how is it that we have a Passover on Thursday night and we have a Passover on Friday? That's not something that people would ordinarily expect. Okay, the original rule that was set down after the temple came into existence in the time of Solomon was that people were supposed to eat the Passover in the temple, that is, in the temple courts. And so that worked until the populace got larger. As time went on, you had more and more people, so they changed the rule and they said you were supposed to eat Passover within the city limits of Jerusalem. But the crowds kept growing year after year as time went on. So then what they would do is they would actually expand the city limits of Jerusalem at feast time. And that made it so that you could be a little further out and you would still be regarded as being in Jerusalem. But then, as the crowds kept increasing, it became useful to utilize the difference in calendars to make it so that there would be two separate days that Passover lambs would be slaughtered, and thereby two separate days that people would eat Passover. Let's talk a little bit about that. We've talked about this earlier, is that other junctures in John's Gospel, it's been important. But I have two mnemonics, Gopher and Jesus. Gopher stands for the Galileans, the Pharisees, rising sun. Jesus stands for Judean Sadducees, setting sun. The start of the day, people I've often treated as the default is going to be at sunset is when the new day would start. That's the pattern that's followed on the right by the Judeans and the Sadducees. But the Galileans and the Pharisees had a different way of telling time. They started it at sunrise, the rising of the sun. Now, let's point out that actually in Genesis chapter 1, evidence is given there that the day was conceived of as starting with the rising sun, as it says, for each day, a day and a night, day one, day and night, day two, day and night, day three, and so forth. So that's pointing towards starting the day at the rising sun. But then there are features within the Old Testament that speak about telling time an alternate way with the setting sun. Both procedures were used, but different groups chose one or the other. They say, okay, well, that's interesting, but it has an important effect. The effect is that there was a rule for how to determine when New Year began. New Year's dating is very important because on the 14th day of the first month of the year, Nisan 14, that's another way of saying the 14th day of Nisan, is when Passover would be. So if you start the New Year a day early or a day late, you're going to move Passover because the 14th day of Nisan is going to be on a different day of the week depending on whether you have started the sun, started the day with the rising sun or the setting sun. How was it that they determined the first day of the new year? As we're all familiar, in March and in September, we have equinox. Equinox is when the day and the night are the same length. Right now, we're approaching the time of year when we have the longest night and the shortest day. That will be the start of winter. But we have the equinox in the spring, and the first new moon after that would be when the new year would start. What's a new moon? It's when the moon becomes invisible because all you're seeing is the dark side of the moon, the side of the moon that is not illuminated by the sun. In Jerusalem, they would appoint two witnesses who would have to swear under oath that they saw, that they were able to verify that there was a new moon, that the moon was not visible. That would then determine this is the first new moon of the new year. But Galileans started their count. It just works out that they said it's Nisan 14 before the people of the Galileans and the Pharisees had one timing. Judeans and Sadducees had an alternate timing. Let's go back a slide, excuse me, the other way. With the numbers of people wanting to eat Passover in Jerusalem increasing, they said, well, we'll let the Galileans eat it on their calendar. As a result of this, in John 13, when Jesus and his disciples ate that meal, it was a Passover meal. One of the things that's said in John 13 is they were reclining. They were not sitting, but they were reclining. And it was at important meals like Passover that people would recline. That was a Passover. But notice the Judeans and the Sadducees in particular observed their Passover on the Friday. That's how we explain what's going on in John 18:28. Even though Jesus ate the Passover on the Passover date of the Galilean calendar, the Sadducees were preparing to eat the Passover that night. Now this has an interesting effect, because there's a passage that tells us when the council, the Sanhedrin, had decided that Jesus needed to be put to death, that they said, well, let's not do this during the feast. And many people have said, well, they did it during the feast. They didn't follow through on what they said. Well, actually, they did follow through, because the Galileans were done with their feast. The Galileans had gone home, ate their meal. They wouldn't be out that night. They would go to bed in the same place they were. And lo and behold, after the Galilean Passover is over, that's the time that all of this is hatching for Jesus to be arrested and tried, so that he's put into the Roman hands, so that he can be put on the cross. And if Galileans, after they've woken up, say, what happened? They will say, well, the Romans are trying Jesus for insurrection. And it was a way of trying to pass the buck. So, this is the often overlooked result of there being two Passover days. Galileans would have celebrated that year Passover on Thursday evening. Therefore, the pro-Jesus Galileans would have kept in their quarters all night. But Judeans, and in particular the Sadducees, were still awaiting their Passover on Friday evening. Judeans who opposed Jesus gathered early Friday morning. Pilate is caught completely off guard. He has no inkling that the crowds that are before him are anti-Jesus. Pilate is aware that Jesus is popular and that the religious leaders are jealous of him, and that that's a major source of the conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders. And Pilate knows that the populace loves Jesus, at least that the Galilean populace does. Pilate is not prepared for having a crowd that wants Jesus crucified. I've heard many sermons through the years that preachers will say, oh, what fickle crowds on Palm Monday in John 12, they welcome Jesus, and then we have them saying, crucify him on the Friday of that same week. That's sloppy. It's different groups. It's not the same people. Lots of preachers are very sloppy on the chronology of this, and it's just plain sloppiness to say the same people welcomed him on Monday or Sunday, as they would say, and wanted him executed Friday. So, Gopher, again, Galileans and the Pharisees start their day at the rising of the sun, and the Judeans and the Sadducees start their day at the setting of the sun. So Gopher and Jesus for the Monomics. Thursday Passover, Friday Passover. Important to keep those two distinct. So now, since the Judean leadership would not go into the Praetorium, Jesus has appeared before Pilate. Pilate has interrogated and so forth, or will have interrogated, but here at this point, this seems to be before any interrogation by Pilate has begun. And so in verse 28, Pilate came outside and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" So he's saying, you need to have a charge, and we need to, I'll determine whether this is for me to deal with or is just some Judean matter that you guys can settle on your own. You want me to do your dirty work. I need to be sure that this is an issue that is for me to deal with. And they say, huh? What's going on? We had an agreement. We told you, you gave us soldiers to help arrest him. You're supposed to take him. And so they are not prepared to have a particular charge. Isn't it interesting? After that whole night of looking for Jesus to incriminate himself, and give evidence that he's leading an insurrection, they're unable to produce that, and they make a general statement: if he were not an evildoer, a troublemaker. That doesn't rise to the level of a capital crime. If he were not an evildoer, we would not have handed him over to you. No. The only reason that they're handing him over is they're afraid of him. They're jealous of him. And they're not able to raise a specific charge that would make it so that Pilate would say, I guess I need to look at him. So, Pilate said, since you haven't given me a charge, you take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. By the way, for those that are not familiar, you'll see dots here in the translation after take yourselves, judge your. This means that each of these uses of you or your or yourselves are plural. Sometimes that's important. So in my translation, which this is my translation here, we have those dots to indicate that they are plurals. Therefore, those Judean leaders said to him, it is not lawful for us to execute anyone. They're saying, our hands are tied. You don't want an insurrection. You hold all the power. You've taken away our ability to execute. The only thing that we can legally execute someone for is a Gentile coming into the court of the women and coming further into the temple. And you've allowed us to have our signs up and so on and so forth, but you don't allow us to do that for other things. Now, if you think about it, there is more than one occasion in Jerusalem that they picked up stones to stone Jesus to death. We see that in John 8. We see that in John 10. It may well have happened in John 5, although it's not mentioned that they actually picked up stones there. But when they say we can't put anyone to death, scruples of Roman law didn't bother them on other occasions. There's something else going on here. They will find it useful for Rome to do the dirty work. But this is actually putting the cart before the horse. Now, I would not want to be that rider. As he can't steer the horse's head. He doesn't have very good aim on that, and it wouldn't be long before he's going off to the side, and they're heading for a crash. This is very dangerous. What has happened here? They haven't even been able to give Pilate a charge, and they're talking about executing Jesus. Is that not the cart before the horse? Jesus has not been demonstrated to have been guilty of a capital crime. They haven't even come up with a capital charge. And yet they're talking about, well, we're not going to do it on our own because he needs to die. This is like Stalin's head of the NKVD, the Soviet secret police. He said, show me the men and I'll find you the crime. In other words, he was quite willing to take a perfectly innocent person and contrive a crime and then create the evidence to make it so that the person could be convicted and executed with a kangaroo court. That's exactly what this kangaroo court is saying. They're saying, we want him dead, we want you to do it, and we're not able to tell you why. So, those Judean leaders said to him, it is not lawful for us to execute anyone. Here's what's important. So Jesus' word, which he said, might be fulfilled, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. If the Judeans had been the ones who would carry out the execution, Jesus would have been stoned to death. Stoning broke bones, but that will be mentioned later, that Jesus will die a death that does not break any bones. But there's more. People are lifted up onto a cross. If someone is stoned, they are not lifted up. They liked to throw people into ditches. Now, I'll make a little digression here for just a moment. There are people that have argued that in Luke chapter 4 that there's evidence that the location that we have for Nazareth is supposedly the wrong location. And the reason that people say that is there isn't any steep embankment that's steep enough that if someone were tossed off it, it would break their neck. Now, what we're told in Luke chapter 4 was that some of the people of Nazareth became very upset about Jesus, so they led him out of town onto the brow of a hill to where they could throw him over a cliff. Well, the objective was not to break his neck. The objective is to make it so that it would be as if they got a little taller. If you have someone in a ditch, which they explain, I mean, there's a dissertation that was written on crucifixion, very interesting dissertation I read a number of years ago, that adduced evidence that the Jews liked, before they stoned someone, to have them at a little lower elevation. If they were just a few feet lower, it was just easier to throw rocks than if they were, the person were at their same height. And so in that passage in Luke 4, The objective wouldn't be to break his neck, but just to make it so that stoning would be easier. But that's a bit of a sidetrack. The issue here is Jesus predicted that he would be lifted up. In John chapter 12, verses 32 and 33, he said, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all to myself." This he said, signifying by what death he would die. He predicted that he would be lifted up to die. He was predicting back in John chapter 12 that it would be Romans, not Judeans, that would put him to death. Interestingly, in John chapter 12, which I didn't include that, here on this passage I cited, but it's there in the context. The people figured out that he was talking about dying. They said, "The law says that the Messiah must remain forever. So who is this Son of Man that you're talking about?" They thought, because Jesus talked about himself dying, that was proof that he couldn't be the Messiah, because how could a Messiah reign forever if he was put to death? The whole issue is Jesus is not one who would live forever by escaping death, but rather he would live forever after being resurrected from death. And so that's the reconciliation on that issue. But notice, Jesus has predicted he would be lifted up. That's the way he would die. And so now at this point, Pilate again entered the palace or the praetorium. He called Jesus, had the guards bring him to him, and said to him, "Are you king of the Judeans?" Now, I've mentioned before that I render all 70 times that the word Eudaios shows up in John, it means Judeans. So we're going to look at this from a couple of different angles. The first one is, what was Pilate thinking? And we have evidence from Luke that tells us specifically what he was thinking. But we also have evidence from the Gospel of John as to what John means by the term Eudaios. So, Luke chapter 23 goes into some detail when the religious leaders first brought Jesus to Pilate. And Pilate was saying, well, you know, what charge, and so on and so forth, and they didn't come up with good answers, so they were all the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people." That's what they meant when they called him an evildoer. He's getting people worked up against us. Now, they're wanting to give Pilate the impression he's stirring them up for an insurrection. But then they added, "teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." And Pilate's thinking, wait a moment, you mean he's a Galilean? Now, Luke goes on to explain that Pilate then, when he found out that Jesus was a resident of Galilee, said, "Oh, Herod is in town. Herod is in charge of Galilee. Let me send Jesus over to him. Maybe he'll take the problem and I won't have to deal with this." Pilate, as you can see, had no idea that Jesus was from Galilee. Why is that important? Pilate has heard the charge that Jesus is claiming to be king of the Eudaioi. Pilate's saying, okay, he's claiming to be king of the Judeans, and he would assume a king of the Judeans would be a Judean. But now he's saying, wait a moment, you mean he's a Galilean and he's claiming to be king of the Judeans? That's something. If Pilate had thought that they were saying king of the Jews, then it wouldn't matter if Jesus were a Galilean. But it surprises Pilate to find out that Jesus lives in Galilee, because Pilate's thinking that they've all along been talking about Jesus is claiming to be king over the Judeans, so Pilate thought he's a Judean claiming to be king of the Judeans. He had no idea that this was, that Jesus would claim to be anything more than that. You might say, but wait a moment, won't Jesus be king over all of Israel? Well, yes, indeed. Let's go back to John chapter 10. Let's look at verse 16. In John chapter 10, verse 16, which we've taught before, I'll do a bit of paraphrasing in order to make a couple of things clear. And other sheep I have, which are not of this fold. The fold he's talking about is the Judean fold. If you see the map, Judea is the southern part of the nation, and Jerusalem is in that southern portion. Jesus is speaking here in John 10 in Jerusalem. So he says, I have other sheep that are not of the Judean fold. That is, I have Galilean and Samaritan sheep. And so he's saying, them also I must bring. I'm going to have to lead them as well. They will hear my voice. Then he's talking, he's predicting future. There will be one flock and one shepherd. He's predicting the reunification of the nation, Judea and Galilee, as one kingdom. Remember, it was split way back after the death of Solomon. Rehoboam became king over Judah, and Jeroboam became king over the north, Israel, which later came to be known as Samaria and included the area of Galilee. The kingdom was split, and it had never been put back together again. Jesus is predicting that in the millennium, he will reunify it. And so, yes, Jesus will be king over more than just the Judeans, but specifically, he is going to be king over the Judeans. It's like, it's a true statement to say he's king over the Judeans. He will be. It's also true to say he'll be a king over the whole nation Israel. But it's also true to say he will be king over the world. And it will also be true to say he's king over the universe. Just because Judean is narrower than Israel, is narrower than whole world, is narrower than whole universe, it's still a true statement. Jesus will be king over the Judeans. Okay, these are the 70 uses of the term eudaios. I've listed them in your notes. Most of these are rendered as Jews, except for John 3:22. That is consistently in every translation rendered as Judean, but every other use here is typically in most translations rendered as Jews. I had a student that did a thesis of arguing for all 70 uses of the term eudaios, meaning Judean, in John's Gospel. There's good evidence for that. So now, Jesus has a response that Pilate here has said, are you king of the Judeans? And Jesus wants to find out if he's parroting what the religious leaders have told him, or whether he has a legitimate question of his own. The nature of what Jesus is doing is saying, if you are asking this because you want to know, I'll frame my answer differently than if you really aren't interested and the only reason you're asking it is because it's part of the charge being brought against me. And so he's saying, are you a parent? Or is this a concern that you actually have on your own? And Pilate snickered, am I a Judean? Do I look Judean? I'm a Roman. We are the ones that are in control. You're part of a subservient nation. I could care less about all your Judean stuff. I couldn't care less about the charges brought against you by the leaders, unless it turns out that you're really dangerous. Then I'll deal with you. But otherwise, I could care less about whether you have some delusion that you're a king. He just was dismissive of Jesus here at this point. He didn't think Jesus was worth all the time that he was having to focus because these religious leaders have some axe to grind and they want Pilate to pull the trigger rather than for them to have blood on their own hands. So then Pilate says, I know that you ticked off your leadership. So what have you done? I mean, specifically, he says, your nation and the chief priests handed you over to me. They don't normally do that. They only deal with me when they have a reason that they don't want their hands dirty. I know they're trying to use me. I don't like it, but until I figure out what's going on, I've got to play along on all this. What have you done? You know, tell me what's really going on here. Is I don't think they're giving me the real story, and I haven't heard it from you either. It is interesting. At this point, Pilate is saying, you know, you can help me figure out what I need to do. You give me the appropriate information, I'll deal with it accordingly. Jesus gives an answer that has been widely misunderstood. My kingdom is not of this world. And so many people think he's saying it's up there, it's in space, it's up there on clouds, and or it's in people's heart, and so on and so forth. That's not what Jesus is saying at all. Jesus isn't saying, I have a pretend kind of a kingdom that is invisible and you don't have to worry about it because my kingdom's invisible and it's not going to bother you. That's not his argument. He will be king over the nation, king over the world, king over the universe, starting with the millennium. What he's saying is, my kingdom is not sourced from this world. It's not growing out of this world. It's not like the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, or any other kingdom that started with man, starting here from planet Earth, just with ordinary means. But instead, my kingdom is sourced from out of this world, sourced with God. And my second coming, I'm going to be back here on planet Earth and I'm going to rule this place with a rod of iron And he's talking about source. My kingdom is not sourced from this world. Now, there's an analogy that I think will help. Jesus has also said that he is not of this world. But that didn't mean that he was like Casper the Ghost. He was there in a physical body. He was in a body that could be crucified. He did live in this world. For him to say that he's not of this world is not a statement that he was not on planet Earth. Jesus spoke of unbelievers as being of this world as well as in this world. He spoke of the 11 as being in this world but not being of this world. In other words, it's possible to be on planet Earth but not to be of this world, not to be sourced in it, because the birth from above is not a birth sourced on planet Earth. Likewise, his kingdom is not of this world, but it will be in this world, that is, it will be on this planet. But Jesus regarded earthly kingdoms as of this world and in this world. So you notice that the two statements above and the two statements below correspond. One cannot take this statement as proof that there will not be a literal millennial kingdom. It does no such thing. What he is saying here, if my kingdom were of this world, then my followers would have revolted, and the religious leaders would not have been able to turn me over to you. In other words, if I had an earthly kingdom, they would have fought against the Judean leadership. I'm not saying that they would have fought against you. So Jesus has spoken about, well, you know, theoretically, if I had a different kind of source for my kingdom, there would have been a revolution, but that's not the way things work. I don't have a revolutionary type of kingdom because it's not starting from planet Earth. It's going to start from outside as I come here and conquer the world as I come in my second coming. He didn't go into all of those details, but that's the point here. Notice he's saying, lest I would be handed over to the Judean leaders. I could have prevented them from having had me in their hands to be able to hand to you, Pilate. My kingdom is not sourced from here. Revolution is not part of my agenda. Notice, this is exactly what Jesus said to Annas. I didn't have a secret agenda. I didn't speak pig Latin to my followers so all of a sudden they've got the signal for when the revolution's supposed to happen. My public message and my private message are consistent with each other. I don't have a secret agenda. All the way through here, Jesus is saying, I don't have a secret agenda. He's consistently said that when he's talked with Judean leadership, and he says it consistently as he talks with Pilate. I don't have a hidden agenda. I've been open and above board, whether in public or in private. Pilate infers out of this, well then, in light of this, are you a king? You just said your kingdom is not sourced from planet Earth, from this world. But that seems to imply that you are saying that you are a king. Pilate has picked up the inference. So Jesus said to him, "You say that I am a king. Now Jesus is going to say something else that's rather interesting. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into this world to testify to the truth." You know, Jesus is the only person in this book that is spoken of as coming into the world. Now, some of our translations, including New King James, do not handle John chapter 1, verse 9 well. John 1, 9, and you might turn there, hold your place where we are, has a bit of ambiguity in the Greek, in that there are two quite different interpretations that can be taken depending upon whether the word come is intended to attach to light or whether it's intended to attach to man. So I'll read the New King James, which I do not like that translation on that verse. That, speaking about Jesus, was the true light which gives light to every man coming into the world. That's treating it as though people come into the world. But Jesus is the only one that's said to come into the world. The better rendering of this, that was the true light which coming into the world gives light to every man. The one coming into the world properly understood in 1:9 is Jesus. We do not speak of children being I would not say that a child born in the United States has come into the United States. No, his parents were in the United States. He's born into the United States, but we don't say he came into the United States. That would assume that he had come from somewhere else. But notice, Jesus doesn't just speak about the purpose of him being born. He adds the purpose for him having come into the world. He's hinting at things that Pilate could have said, "What are you talking about?" Now, Jesus gave him opportunity. Earlier, he said, "Are you a parrot? Are you asking me this question because you have conviction? You start wondering about it? Or are you asking it just parroting the charges that were brought against me?" Once again, Jesus is giving Pilate opportunity to say more. Pilate doesn't bite. He's not interested. Jesus makes an interesting follow-up here. "Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Who is it that listens to his voice? Those that are his. Believers. Let's look at some passages. In John 5:25, "Amen, amen, I tell you, an hour is coming and now is." An hour is coming and now is. It means it's new to his hearers, but it's presently occurring. "When the dead," that is the spiritually dead, unbelievers, "will listen to the voice of the Son of God, and those who listen will live." Verse 24, right before this, says, "Amen, amen, I tell you, the one who hears my word and believes in the one who sent me has everlasting life, shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life." This is talking about listening and believing. Those who hear the Son of God are believers. Same chapter, verse 37. "Also, the Father himself who sent me has testified about me. You have never heard his voice, nor have you seen his form. Not hearing the Father through the Father's word is a reference to unbelievers. And then talking about the sheep, the shepherd in John 10. To the shepherd, the gatekeeper, the one who guards over the flock at night, opens the gate. The sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them forth. And when he has put forth his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. Time out, believers. 10:16a. I have other sheep. We've quoted this passage before earlier this evening, which are not of the sheepfold, that is, are not of Judea. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. Again, time out, believers. And in verse 27a of the same chapter, my sheep hear my voice. When Jesus says, everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice, those who are of the truth are believers. Pilate isn't really listening at this point. Pilate remains an unbeliever. Pilate said to him, what is truth? Now, many people think that Pilate is asking a deep philosophical question. I don't think so. Pilate is a military man who's kind of out of his league. The history of his dealing with the Sadducees is that he got outclassed time and time and time again. I think he's scoffing at Jesus. What is truth? What does it matter? What matters is I need to get you out of my hair. I want to be done with this. I'd really rather not do a favor for the Judeans, the Sadducees that have brought charges or are wanting me to deal with you, even though they haven't really brought any capital charges against you. He's just scoffing. What is truth? I could care less. I want to be done with this and deal with other things. I've got this feast coming up and there are always problems, and I have been fussing over you. So now, Pilate is going to be blindsided. Remember we talked earlier, he knew that the crowds were pro-Jesus. He figures, all I have to do, I can outsmart the Sadducees. All I have to do is say, well, I can release Jesus, or I can release one of those revolutionaries that you all hate. You might be thinking, wait a moment, why would they hate revolutionaries? They don't like the Romans. Well, the people didn't like it because they ended up getting sideways with them. Think about what's going on in Israel, there are certain similarities. Won't go into more detail, but I think you can make connections. There are lots of problems that would happen, but so that people would suffer at the hands of the insurrectionists, the bandits, but also the leadership was very fearful because they knew that if they lost control, the Romans would take over. And it would become martial law. It would become far more difficult. They didn't like Roman law as it was, but they knew that Roman martial law would be worse than what they were experiencing. So no one wanted revolutionaries to be released. And Pilate knew that. So he thought, the people love Jesus. This is going to go against the religious leaders, and I'll be done with this. I'll just offer to make a prisoner swap, and everything will be just fine, and the religious leaders and Jesus can continue to squabble with each other, and I'll be done with it. So he announces that he finds no charge. After saying this, he went outside to those Judeans and told them, "I find in him no charge." But then he adds in verse 39, "It is a custom for you that I release for you one man for you at Passover. So do you wish for me to release the king of the Judeans for you?" So they all shouted again, "Not this one, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a bandit. Once again, this is a group that's loyal to the Sanhedrin. It's not the ordinary populace that gathered around Jesus at the feast. These are enemies that have been hand-gathered. Remember, the Galileans have had Passover. They're all asleep. But the Sadducees have had plenty of time to gather together a hand-picked crowd that hates Jesus. Now, he's called a bandit here, but Mark 15:7 indicates that he also was a murderer, and this is in keeping with him being an armed bandit or revolutionary. The words are used by Josephus to describe the revolutionary bandits. They would rob from people in order to raise funds. They would hold up caravans and so forth, but ultimately they wanted to overthrow the Romans, and if they could steal from the temple, they'd do that. They're everybody's enemy, and that's why Pilate is thinking, okay, this is the way I can get out of all of this. So, in this passage, what we've seen is Jesus stands up courageously. He continues to say that he has a consistent message, the same message whether he's in private or in public. He is not a revolutionary. His kingdom is not sourced in this world. It will come about through divine intervention at his second coming. On the other hand, Peter, who stood up and said, "I'll even die with you, for you," he denies Jesus second and third times. Pilate is getting outsmarted by the high priests, but everything is going according to plan. Everything that Jesus has predicted happens exactly as it was supposed to happen. He will be crucified. And through that, he will pay the sin's death penalty for the entire world. Things are going according to plan, but he's under the power of the high priest, Annas, then Caiaphas. Comes under the authority of Pilate. Pilate doesn't just say, "Well, I find no charge, I release him." He just continues to play games with religious leadership and eventually gets trapped into crucifying Jesus. Peter, who thought that he was so strong, fails. But it's all going according to plan. Courage in the court, cowering in the courtyard.